Hi, welcome to Inside Learning, episode 128 for the 5th of December 2013. Dueling Panchos. Good evening, Jay. Those are words I haven't said for a long while.
Jay, who's this Jay fella? Oh, hello, it's me. Hello, Matthew, how are you?
I'm fantastic, Jay. We've been flagging up on the website for quite a while and talking with unbridled excitement about your return, your leap off the bench, so welcome back.
Well, you know, I was just saying yesterday to Lord Lucan and Shergar how much I've missed you guys.
Yeah, we've got awful serious in your absence, actually. The pun ratio has gone far too low, so I'm hoping you're going to remedy that for us tonight.
I'll do my best.
What have you been up to recently?
Little and lots, really. Mostly work stuff. We've entered silly season officially now. All the children are preparing for the... we had a pantomime last week, and they're preparing for our nativity in a fortnight's time. So, yeah, it's just a crazy time of year in school.
Fantastic. And we have a guest tonight. Very excited to introduce Gillian Campbell-Thow to... to Hello. Yourself, Jay, and to our listeners.
Good evening. Hello.
Good evening.
Gillian is a really interesting mix of talents, if you don't mind me saying, Gillian, because you're still a working PT of a large languages department in Glasgow.
Yes, I am.
And you're an advisor in modern languages for Glasgow City as well. I mean, that's a tough thing to juggle.
Certainly. Yep.
The old idea that advisors get out of date isn't going to be an immediate problem for you.
No. It's good to be on the shop floor, so to speak.
Absolutely. And the reason that we've asked Gillian to join us tonight is that you were also, Gillian, on the national group that came up with the 1+2 languages initiative that local authorities are...
Yeah, guilty as charged, Matthew, guilty as charged.
Well, it may turn out to be a great thing. So Scottish local authorities are all wrestling with how they're going to implement this initiative. And, it's certainly very much part of curriculum for excellence and the spirit of being part of a global economy. So it's going to be exciting stuff, and we're going to get in and about that in just a short while. So welcome, sure. Gillian. It's great to have
Thank
you on board.
Thank you. Yeah, nice to be here.
Okay. It's funny, without Steve here, suddenly I'm all lost, Jay. I'm thinking, right, do we do football or don't we?
I'm good with football, boys. I'm good with football. So
actually, we have nothing to do with football, Gillian, generally, but we can never resist just checking if Steve's beloved team has done well or not. So I'll tell you what, I'll just make you the substitute in every sense tonight. How have the Blues done?
The Blues did very well last night. We went to Manchester United and beat them 1-0, so that was a very good result for us.
Oh, that was surprisingly much less satisfying than I thought. I always like when Steve... I still hope he's not listening, because I always deny this, but I always quite like when he says Arsenal get beat. There's something about the really enthusiastic football fan that, you know, it brings out the old Schadenfreude in you, doesn't it?
Well, Arsenal yesterday won as well, which in itself isn't so revolutionary, but... Nicholas Bentner scored, which is a little bit like saying Michael Gove said something that went down well with the teaching profession. So that was
talking about Gove. Did you see the title that was doing the rounds this week? I don't know if it was Facebook or Twitter.
The book on Amazon.
Yeah,
I posted that on Facebook. It's what everything I know about teaching by Michael Gove. And you go to Amazon, it's $4.99 or something like this. But you click the check inside the book tab that you can do, and it's completely blank pages. But the reviews on Amazon are a real treat. Go and have a look. Michael Gove, What I Know About Education on Amazon, the reviews are brilliant.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that's homework.
Okay, so to let us get into the languages conversation tonight. And I should just say, having bad-mouthed poor Steve, now that we've got Bill on board a little bit more often, you know, Steve and I are getting the occasional night off from the podcast, so this is Steve's first one for quite a long while, so I hope he's enjoying himself. And he will be back with us next week, because obviously listeners, you know, will be crying and stuff, all sorts all over the place, you know, where is our beloved Steve? So, hurry back, Steve. Anyway, let's crack on with some news. Let's have Gillian as our guest get us rolling. What's the big story then that you've picked up on this week? Because I think it's the same one that we've all picked up on, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. It's definitely been the intense media coverage about the PISA testing, and I think, you know, the results showing, you know, how Scottish learners are performing better, say, than their counterparts in England was quite interesting. I think for me as a linguist, you know, it's more about the STEM subjects than perhaps my own subject. But it's fairly interesting because things like PISA testing and CAT testing, there's a lot of schools, you know, they stand by the weight of these tests. And it was interesting to kind of look at, you know, Alistair Allen's blog on Engage for Education. You know, and he's, you know, they're kind of talking about basically the latest sets of results were kind of done before Curriculum for Excellence really kind of impacted, and we're looking perhaps at results of children who have not come through the first cohort to come through Curriculum for Excellence, and you know, he's kind of focusing primarily on the whole idea of kind of social background and what you know, what we're doing in terms of closing the gap and things. I find it very, very interesting. Fairly kind of meaty to kind of digest, you know, when you're just a wee languages teacher. However, I did find it quite interesting. They were looking at kind of Norway and saying, you know, that, you know, they seem to have gone down and, you know, Scotland's kind of gone up, and yet quite often, and particularly in this kind of political climate, we're often looking at a lot of the kind of, we're looking at the Nordic and Scandinavian countries as potential models for where we want to go, you know, post kind of referendum, you know, if that's the way that it goes. So I think not only from an educational point of view, but I think it's quite interesting from a political point of view.
Can I suggest then, since that we did have a quick chat beforehand, and that's the story we've all spotted as the most important this week, and it's a big one, why don't we just be disciplined this week? We'll just focus on that before we get into our languages chat, if that suits everyone.
Cool.
Okay. Sure. So there's a couple of things there that immediately grabbed me. One is that, in a sense, the excuse making starts already, doesn't it? You know, that you know, we're getting a new curriculum, but this doesn't measure the effect of a new curriculum. Is that because it's 15-year-olds it's been focused on?
Yep. I mean, basically what they're saying is that the results, you know, are kind of fairly similar to the performance in 2009.
Yeah.
So you would kind of think, well, you know, so obviously there hasn't been, but again, I think they would see in the next cohort, then it's obviously going to be a wee bit different. There's that excuse there, I think.
And the other thing there, of course, is Michael Gove, south of the border, used a very similar excuse, didn't he? Shushed.
Shush that Gove man, indeed.
Because the Govester had made some astonishing statements. We've got a history over the years now in the podcast of just you know, having broken jaws and stuff when we read out the things that Gove has said. In this case, he true to form didn't disappoint by saying that, first of all, yes, this is the lamentable state that the Labour Party have left our education system in. Mm, is it three years or something into their tenure now? Is it something that ballpark? He also said it will be a decade before you can measure the impact of our reforms. I thought, well, there's no messing around here with your blogs like you've just described, saying, well, in a couple of years we might see the effect. No, Gove has said this one's in the long grass, nothing to do with us. You know, it's the ultimate Teflon-shouldered statement, isn't it?
Uh-huh. There was a really good quote in the Telegraph, and he's basically saying, you know, it was the whole idea that the results of the OECD's PISA test are great, not for our children, obviously, but for our politicians, because if you're a politician, the PISA results can be used to prove whatever you want, you know, which I thought was quite interesting from the Telegraph. But yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm intrigued by that. I'm also not quite clear on why we're saying that in Scotland, Curriculum for Excellence hasn't really had an impact yet. Because if it's 15-year-olds, when did they actually sit the tests? I'm not quite clear on that.
Well, I think they sit them. Do they not sit them let me see, the assessments of 15-year-olds' abilities? These ones were 2012.
Yeah, it's a year ago that this cohort were tested.
Yep.
Which means that they would have been probably 9 or 10 when Curriculum for Excellence first started in primary schools anyway, mm-hmm. to be developed. So, yeah, I mean, I think the next set of tests in 3 years from now will maybe give a clearer indication of how children are performing who've gone through more of CFE as part of this schooling curriculum. But My whole thing about the PISA tests is, you know, I think they're very, very valid results. Sorry, very reliable results in terms of, you know, it's a neutral by context and things like this, and all the children in all the countries in the OECD nations go through the same kind of test. But I don't know how valid it is, because, you know, you're testing something that, or three things that are very, very narrow. You know, there's reading ability, maths and science. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't give you a sense of how children will apply skills. It doesn't give you a sense of how well-rounded they are as people. There are aspects of it which say, you know, assess or ask them anyway, how contented they are in school and how hard they work and how they value education. Do they skip school and things like this, which might be indicators of how well they're developed as a rounded person. Mm. But I don't think you can take such a broad sweep and actually get anything like depth from it.
No, and particularly one of the things that they did pick up on was the fact that children who are perhaps coming from maybe kind of poorer social backgrounds or areas of high social deprivation, if you ask them how hard they're trying or how contented they are, then that's obviously going to have an impact, you know, on how they perform in it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just going to sound a wee warning here, though, that there's an awful lot of this current about whether, you know, they're you know, valid because they don't test those deeper skills, and whether, you know, the cultural contexts are allowing us to make proper comparisons. I know this was a theme that Bill brought up in the podcast last week in anticipation of this week's results. But actually, if you have a wee look online at the kind of PISA, you know, sample items and the structure that they use to make sure that they're, you know, that they're questions, so that their questions are transferable and you know, mm-hmm. check basic skills. I think they've done not a bad job of making sure that they go beyond very basic skills. A lot of it is about and you know, how to draw inferences and you know, how to interpret things more deeply and more subtly, you know. So yes, I don't disagree entirely, Jay, with that. You know, I don't think it can ever be perfect at that, but I think they've gone way beyond just the basic, and I think people are pretty critical of these who haven't maybe looked at some of the sample items.
Yeah, but what I mean by skills, I'm talking about broader skills or wider skills. A lot of the literature you'll read this week in the news outlets is about, you know, and certainly the OECD themselves are saying it's important to measure people really fairly and really accurately, and sometimes the results are not very comfortable for people. But you know what? Youngsters are going.
Oh.
We've lost Jay. I suspect that's my fault. I've just hit a button. I just realised there was a window there saying we accept video from this call, and I thought, oh, I'll just click that. It'd be nice to see Jay's smiling face. That may have been an error. Are you still there, Jay? He'll be back with us in a moment. We'll just we'll hold on. Jay, for listeners who don't know, is out in Argyll, out quite close to Loch Ilped, in a very rural area, and broadband isn't great. And to add to that, today there have been really bad storms, and you know, lines and power and all sorts have been down, and schools closed, and it's very possible that there's a lot of pressure on the internet there.
Yeah.
So no doubt he'll be back. I feel really silly now for having clicked that button.
I'm not even going to refer to our earlier technological conversation, Matthew.
I can't remember what came up there. Technological conversation. You didn't have to.
Funny that. Funny that.
Anyway, we'll let Jay come back and make his defence of that point shortly. Okay. There was another interesting thing, Gillian. Did you pick mm-hmm. up that this time round, for the first time, they gave us a split between the home nations, even though it was recorded as a UK result?
Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So they had, what was it, Scotland was performing better for maths and
reading.
Science, reading, but England was just, it was only about 3 points higher for science, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's a really interesting story. Mm-hmm. Did you have any thoughts on it before I wandered on?
Well, I think there's obviously been a massive push on numeracy and literacy, and that's got to, you know, have had an impact. I think it's interesting because it's been a fairly interesting time for scientists, you know, for kind of further up the curriculum. If you look at curriculum for excellence, and I know there's been a lot of kind of challenges that the science teachers are currently looking to meet. You know, so I think that's probably one of the things. But I think that the push in numeracy and literacy has been a massive thing.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure that's right. But what was really interesting, I thought, additionally about that, was that Although we've got headlines now trumpeting that, you know.
Hello.
Oh, Jay, hi.
Hello.
I'm so sorry about that. What happened?
Gee, I think I might be the problem, yeah. I've just explained to everyone how the bandwidth is out there and how it's probably worse tonight with the weather. I just realised there was a window on my screen saying, will you accept video from Jay? Presumably you'd try to turn it on at the start or something. And I just suddenly, you know that bit that you know, you shouldn't touch that button. If someone writes the button, do not touch this button. I did think for a moment, oh, his bandwidth might be a bit short tonight. But what the hell? So I clicked the button and you disappeared just at the instant I clicked it. So it was pretty surely me.
You're a bugger because I had just said the most erudite and witty and sensible comment I've ever made. And now I can't remember what it was.
It was you peaked then.
I peaked, absolutely, you peaked. And you missed it.
Cut you off in your prime. Okay, well, we'll bring you back to that point in a wee minute. We're just pursuing the difference between the home nations and you know how the headlines have picked up on that. And I was just you know, Gillian was just saying, Jay, that the push in Scotland on basic skills, literacy and numeracy, you know, may well be the reason why Scotland did better in those. But I was actually thinking what was really interesting is that, you know, the UK result is still what is reported in PISA. You know, the split within that isn't, you know, reported as separate nations. And when you look at it, it is only, was it 3 points you said, Gillian, was the difference in science?
Yeah.
When you actually look at the graph, you can see that although there is a difference between, you know, Wales, England, Scotland in performance, it's nothing. You know, although we're talking about it as though it's hugely significant, you know, compared to, you know, your Singaporean results at the top and your, you know, your United Arab Emirates, you know, languishing down near the bottom, you know. There's no difference. You know, the UK nations are all the same, and that fascinated me. Because when you think how different the work is that Gove has been driving in the English system and what we've got here with Curriculum for Excellence, and to be honest, I still don't fully understand the Welsh curriculum. You know, to have those results so similar in the PISA test probably tells you, doesn't it, that this is very cultural. You know, maybe young people's performance in this is perhaps more driven by our shared media and shared culture than by the differences in the, you know, the education systems.
I think that's probably part of it and probably a big part as well. But, you know, don't forget, we're talking about 15-year-olds, and I'm just rehashing a point we've already made, but 15-year-olds being assessed last year who have been educated under Curriculum for Excellence for only a very short period of time. You know, we're talking about the broad general education aspect of CFE only being a couple of years old in secondary schools.
Yeah.
So it would be really, really difficult to say whether the English curriculum reforms and Scottish curriculum reforms have had an impact at this point.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that it was on the BBC, Jamie McIver, who's one of the education correspondents, and it's a really, really valid point, is about the amount of people in Scottish kind of education that are actually playing down the PISA rankings. For example, because they're so kind of specific skills, you know, like, you know, obviously the science and the math, but at the heart of Curriculum for Excellence, you really look at that kind of deeper learning and understanding. So, you know, it's maybe then that, you know, the tests are only covering these specific skills and therefore don't give a very kind of accurate picture.
Yeah, the point I was making just before when I lost the connection and at the risk of repeating myself, I will say again in case you missed it, but it's, you know, we're talking about or OECD. They are talking about the reason for PISA and the fact that we have international comparators because young people need to be competitive in a global marketplace. Well, sure, you need math skills, you need literacy skills, you know, and a certain amount of science knowledge, I suppose, to succeed in a global economy. But you also need entrepreneurial skills, the ability to manage risk and to take risks at the right time, the ability to be creative, to think on your feet. And I'm just not sure whether PISA tests actually can measure that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because one of the things I would say, well, really, if you want to compete on a global market, then you need to put a language test in there. You know, a modern language test, but clearly I'm biased.
I was just going to say, that's in your unbiased opinion.
It's in my very unbiased opinion, as you know. However, it's quite interesting for someone who sat on a higher maths, granted a very long time ago. I've never used it since, never.
Well, I think Gove has the solution, does he not? If everybody spoke Latin, we wouldn't have a problem.
I would like to batter him.
So you're standing in for Steve this week then?
Yes, so that's been roughly translated but on everybody else, I would like to do him grievous bodily harm.
Okay. Well, I guess... Oh, carry on.
Love the way the language specialist puts it. I'm going to batter him. See him.
What can you do?
Oh, dear. Yeah, before we go too far down this road, because I can see us getting drawn into it, you know, I suppose a question that would be interesting to unpick maybe some other week is, if you look at the high-performing nations and states, are they being creative? You know, is there any correlation? I don't know. Did any of you read anything about that before we move on?
Do you know, I think maybe if I can kind of, it is quite interesting when you look at, for example, they've got, let's say your top 10 reading, you know, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore. I spent a year working in China with VSO, and, you know, it was a real eye-opener to see the kind of different kind of methodologies, but the value that the learners place in education and the parents place in education there is unbelievable. So extremely motivated. I mean, I was teaching from, say, 8 in the morning till 8 or 10 at night, you know, and everybody turned up. Everybody was in their classes, but the support from kind of parents as well because of the values. And I don't know whether there's that kind of correlation of the kind of support from home. I mean, I'm not saying that's one of the reasons that's impacted greatly on PISA, but having worked in a system where you know, particularly in China, then I can probably say, yep, you can see, because it's a completely different methodology, but also just a completely different attitude towards education.
Yeah, yeah. Gillian, this won't do though, I'm afraid. That's an opinion that's informed by you working there for a year. We prefer people just to have, you know, just to have, you know, weightless, frothy opinions. we're actually going to have to take that seriously. This isn't cricket.
Seriously. Sorry about that. But I'll stop being serious. Right, back to the battering, people.
Absolutely. It's a very, very serious point. It is one you hear a lot, isn't it, about the, you know, the the Eastern and Pacific Rim countries. Remember the theory, Jay, that
there's a Malcolm Gladwell talks
Gladwell
about.
Put forward, yeah. He poo-pooed it. He thought it was nonsense. But what was it?
He talked about cultural bias in success. Was it in Outliers? I think I tell you, it was in Tipping Point, which is a book that he's beginning to step away from quite a lot. You hear any recent interviews with Malcolm Gladwell. But what he was saying about math students, he's talking about American students of Oriental descent and why they're particularly good at maths in the US system. And what he was saying is one of the reasons is linguistically, the way that young Oriental Americans are taught to count and to add, they don't have a separate word for 13, but it's 10 and 3 and 10 and 4 and so on and so forth, which helps them to visualize the number system easier. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much truth is in that, but it's an interesting theory.
Interesting. Yeah, actually, that should transfer quite a lot to the French system as well, then, Gillian, shouldn't it? The numerical system has language that actually has the sums in the language in places, doesn't it?
So, yeah, it does in some of the numbers, it does. But the interesting thing, getting back to Chinese, though, and getting back to Mandarin, don't mention David Cameron, whatever you do, because he thinks learning Mandarin's going to solve it all. However, remember, it's characters. So when they learn how to do the characters, then they can, it's almost like a wee story goes along with each of these characters. So there's something to be said for that, you know, the language and the way that it's learned. It was interesting. There was a small Twitter explosion last night about our lovely friend David Cameron saying that learning Mandarin would solve all of Britain's problems, to which my response to that was, he is a tool.
I take it we're talking about the national prime minister, not the friend of the podcast, David Cameron.
No, not the friend of the podcast. No, we're talking about the prime minister. I'm just checking. It was put forward by Joe Dale, who you all know and who we all love, and to which he then said, yes, I can hear you saying that with your broad accent. He is a tool. But there we are.
Okay.
I was always brought up to believe that tools are useful things.
Certainly not when you're from Ayrshire and you call someone a tool, Jay. What can you do?
Well,
I'm learning as we go.
The sharp ones are useful. But anyway, let's move on. Thank you for bringing authority and knowledge instead of our usual bum-gumping opinion there, Gillian. But let's move on to the second issue tonight, which is to try and unpick the 1+2 Languages Initiative for folk. Could you give us a quick, kind of brief summary of where we are with that and what it is for listeners, bearing in mind that only probably about half our listeners are actually from Scotland?
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Well, basically, it was one of the SNP's flagship policies, and what they want to do and to deliver over two parliaments is to make sure that every primary school child in Scotland learns two languages over and above their mother tongue. So there was a process set up of engagement, and there was a national languages strategy group brought together, consisting of very, very clever people and academics, and then me, clearly for the comedy value. And we met together to look at, you know, how would this work? What's the existing model and what have you, to give you an idea. Languages are one of the eight curricular areas that have to be delivered, obviously, in Curriculum for Excellence. But previous to this, modern languages have been delivered in the primary. And there have been various papers and various movements. There's been, obviously, Citizens for a Multilingual World, and there's been all sorts of talk about entitlement. But the picture, as it stands, pre-1+2, was that at least from primary six, children should be learning a foreign language for a fixed period of time per week. That language should be the same one that they go into study in secondary school. But that wasn't working, you know, the transitions weren't working. And also as well, we had so many talented practitioners who were taking that much further down the curriculum. So the group was set up to look at how this could be delivered over two parliaments, you know, looking at the implications for training, look at the implications for resourcing, and obviously the big one, the financial implications for it as well. Where we're at the moment is that the paper and the recommendations have all gone to Parliament. They've all been accepted, except for about four of them, which have only been partially accepted. And it's now with the Strategic Implementation Group. The funding has been released to local authorities, and local authorities, they now have to take that forward and make it fit for their own local authority. And my general comment on that would be, it's interesting times.
Okay. Jay, has this crossed your radar yet as a head teacher in a primary school?
It was too hard. 1+2 hasn't per se, but certainly language teaching has, you know, and we do our best. I don't think we always achieve, but we do our best to teach Gaelic in the school. Not me personally, because I don't have a word of it, but and also French as our modern foreign language. I've got a few things, thumping opinions, I suppose, about language, particularly in, well, I was going to say particularly primary school, but across the board, I think. And one is, you know, I agree with Gillian absolutely that it's a vital part of education for a number of reasons. One, I think it teaches not just another language, but an ability to think and make connections, which is really important. But also as young people grow, it widens their horizons, not just in terms of how they can communicate with other people, but their knowledge of other cultures, which is really, really key. Excuse me. My worry is one of pedagogy when it comes to language teaching. You know, I once heard somebody say, I want to say it was Keir Bloomer, but it might not have been, but I once heard somebody say that, you know, we teach nothing as badly as modern foreign languages in schools in terms of what children actually leave school with an ability to do. I myself, I studied Spanish to A-level and came out knowing about eight words, you know, past A-level, but couldn't convert a Spanish person at all.
Mm-hmm. I loved something you said, Gillian, when we met and chatted about, you know, our implementation of this. when you talked about the distinction between, I can't remember the phrase you used, but it was language acquisition, is that it, rather than language learning?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the big things. I mean, what the traditional pattern has been is that children have a language lesson for, say, 45 minutes a week, and it's language learning. It's specifically for modern foreign language learning. You know, you spend half your time recapping on what you've already done, you know, and trying to take that kind of progression forward. The whole idea of bringing it down, for example, to P1 and earlier in nurseries, we've got some great examples in Glasgow, I have to say, of nurseries who use language acquisition. And it's just, if you think about, you know, how a baby, you know, learns their mother tongue, I mean, they're basically exposed to the language, they're listening to it for over a year before they start to kind of vocalise, or obviously in my case, about 8 months apparently, and was handed my first phone bill at two. however, but you think, so children, you know, they... they're surrounded by all this language before they start vocalising it. You look at the then kind of false environment we create in P6, it's like, right, I'm going to listen to these six words for 5 minutes and then you have to see them, read them and write them, okay? However, when we look at language acquisition, that's where it becomes part and parcel of normal practice, where children are exposed to the language in different types of kind of situations. So, you know, one of the examples we'll use is, you know, they're maybe sitting around a snack table at nursery and how many people are here today? Oh, that's right, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you would say that in whatever language they were learning. You don't get them to repeat it. We don't say it after me. We just say it every day so that it becomes part and parcel of normal practice. So they learn through play. They learn through kind of contextualised learning, the same way as people pick up their mother tongue. And for me, it's quite interesting with my daughter because, I mean, I use Spanish with her, but I don't say, right, now she's had half an hour Spanish lesson. She's only in P1, you know? So that idea of where you just pick up through day-to-day and normal practice. And that's certainly, and again, I can only speak knowledgeably about what we're doing in Glasgow, but that's one of the big things that we're working on with our early years staff and training for early years in primary.
Okay.
Yeah, you remind me of something that David Cameron once said, not the Prime Minister, but our friend David Cameron, who once, you know, he was talking about 5 to 14 and the way the, you know, curriculum percentages. So we teach 25% English, 25% maths, and then different subjects get weightings. And he said, it's ridiculous, you know, that you finish your English lesson and now we're going to study history, or we're going to do our history lesson, but we're not going to use any English language at all. And I think it should be the same as you're saying, Gillian, for modern foreign languages as well, or Gaelic, if that's
absolutely
the language you're using. And it's teaching through French rather than teaching of French.
The interesting thing for that, Jay, is though what you will then hear from HMI, because, I mean, for example, if you take like learning numbers, okay, and the kind of natural thing for that is, oh, we can do some maths and numbers. Children still need to be able to attain in their mother tongue, you know. So they still need to be able to, for example, you know, do things in their mother tongue as well as doing it in a foreign language. And yet you find that, you know, that they're bursting to do it. You know, they get that such a sense of achievement and such a sense of kind of pride. But what the thing that we really lack, though, is teacher confidence and teacher ability to deliver that at primary. I mean, you'll see one of the recommendations from the 1+2 paper that was only partially accepted was that primary teachers, either on entry or on exit from initial teacher education, had the equivalent of a higher language. Now, of course, we're all saying that's fabulous, but quite rightly so, the scientists are saying, well, should they not have a science? You know, other subject areas, should they not have this? Should they not have that? That was the one that's only been partially accepted. And the big problem for that is really, you know, is the confidence and also the ability of primary teachers to be able to do that.
That's really, sorry, Jay, I cut you off there. Carry on.
No, I was just going to say, I agree with you absolutely, Gillian. I think the idea that we should have a language qualification upon teacher entry, and scientists are saying, why not a science one? I think we would generally, or more people would generally have a more basic understanding of science than they would of French or something like that. So there's a need for additional input with a modern foreign language for many prospective teachers. And the other thing, just to come back to what I was saying about curricular weightings, I've had a lot of conversations with colleagues over the past couple of years as we talk about things like interdisciplinary learning and enterprise learning and all of these different kind of aspects of learning. And colleagues are saying, well, you know, how are we going to fit this in? Because we've got all of these other subject areas to teach. And the answer is always the same for me. The answer is always because we're doing it all simultaneously. And I think that's the place for modern foreign languages. And the idea that a young person would need to be able to be numerate or need to be able to critically analyse a text, for example, or be able to achieve in science, if they can do it in a different language to a certain extent, they can definitely do it in their mother tongue as well.
Yeah.
Well, taking that aside, obviously, I think that is a really valid and important point because these other things are clearly critical, and science is a good example of one that primary schools do have a real, like you're saying, everyone's got a basic understanding of it, Jay, but some people's is so basic that they struggle to not implant bad ideas early on, and indeed they're so responsible as teachers and care so much that they try not to implant any in case they get it wrong. But anyway, that aside, because I think there are easy answers to that. One of the things that interests me, so I shouldn't say that, everybody would say what easy answers, but there are lots of people like our colleague and friend James Wiley, Jay, who brings more specialists in, and you know, mixes up the kind of secondary and primary model of curriculum, and that's happening in lots of other places, isn't it?
Yeah,
and that certainly lets you spread it, you know, expertise and remove that fear factor a little bit while still covering the very wide curriculum. But what's really interesting is this isn't the first time that Scotland's wrestled with a conscience about trying to, well, not with a conscience, you know, with a practical problem of trying to engage more with the world and to be, you know, more, you know, commercially, you know, viable as well as the other, you know, positive aspects. And we didn't get it right before. I'm sure I remember 20 years ago, you know, we made uptake of languages compulsory in secondary schools, you know, at exam level, you know, for one language or something like that at least. And we've stepped back from that again because we didn't find it, you know, a success, did we? So do you have any sense of, or maybe I shouldn't say that, but, you know, it didn't achieve what we set out to achieve, which was obviously to have a much more universal, you know, high skill level in languages. When you read the 1+2 paper, it's very, very ambitious and very, you know, very clear in its really lofty aim. Have you got a sense of what is going to be different this time, Gillian?
Well, first of all, I'd like to state for the record that I probably wasn't even born when you were talking about all these changes going on. No, I'm only kidding. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, languages were made compulsory. And you know, obviously being biased and whatever else, there's part of me that said, well, you know, I think it still should be compulsory. But then it's the same as many other things. I mean, the kind of value that's placed on modern languages varies. Okay, there's no kind of parity of people saying it's got to be. And one of the big things I think at the heart of the 1+2 paper was you have to win hearts and minds. Okay, but that's not only just with people and with students opting to take languages, but that's also with staff as well. And it's about realising that, you know, that there's always going to be a place for the pure academic study of modern languages. But similarly as well, SQA have now realised this as well. There's a far more kind of, there's a suite of qualifications that are far better and are far more accessible now. I think a lot of it comes down to the teaching and learning, but also in terms of what is being assessed. Do I think we're getting it right? You know, it's an interesting one in terms of curriculum build, because you're looking at schools who are still using the 3-3 model. So they're using broad general education till the end of third year and then into options. We still have schools that use 2-2-2 model, where you're choosing options after second year. We still have schools that have modern languages as a core subject, because A, they're delivering, they're getting attainment, and the kids are engaged. You know, are we getting it right yet? Don't think so. I mean, the numbers, the kind of latest figures is that numbers were going down significantly for French, German, and Italian, but they were increasing a wee tiny bit in Spanish.
Mm.
So, you know, there are various factors, I think, that are affecting that. But I think a lot of it is down to the teaching and learning. A lot of it's down to pedagogy as well, you know. And it's difficult because it's a constant, I wouldn't say battle, but challenge to keep up with the ever kind of changing face of technology, to be able to use that, to look at good, decent teaching and learning, and also to make it relevant, you know. I mean, gone are the days where, you know, you'd have kids learning, say, 20 different animals. What's more important now is they can say, I have, or I like, or I don't like, and being able to manipulate structures rather than just having lists and lists of words that they're never ever going to use. And I think we need to do a big change in terms of the kind of the mindset of our teaching and learning for modern languages.
Well, that's a pretty good summary, Jay. As we get near the end of the podcast, what's your thinking on what we've been hearing about 1+2?
I think the ambitions are absolutely correct and absolutely laudable. I think the reasons for young people learning a second and a third language are, they're very sound. But yeah, just to echo what Gillian was saying, I think it's a matter of pedagogy as well. And how do we strike that balance between, you know, I was talking before about teaching through a foreign language. You know, in primary school, I can see that being, over the course of a couple of years, a very, very possible scenario. I don't know how that would work in the siloed world of secondary schools, given the structure of schools that we have at the moment.
Yeah.
Okay, well, just briefly to try and tidy up that loose end, because you know, if it's going to be successful in primary schools, we need an awful lot of confidence in teachers, you know, taking on some new language skills. Gillian, how do you see that challenge?
It's a huge challenge. It really is, because each education authority has been asked to come up with a model that suits them. And previously, you know, we had it was a Scottish-wide model, which meant that everyone was being trained in the same way. They were using the same materials and things. And I can understand the need for kind of creativity and that the one size does not fit everyone. However, I think the moment that the challenge is for authorities is to take that forward, to be creative, to be adventurous, and that can be difficult. I think it'd be difficult when you don't have someone who's got that kind of blue sky thinking, and who maybe don't kind of realise the kind of implications of, you know, training people for 2 days in a foreign language and sending them out to a primary school with a CD of songs and thinking that everything's going to be okay. That's my big concern. My big concern is about the kind of validity of some of the training that's going on, and also teachers' confidence as well, because it's not good enough to get the pronunciation wrong. It's not good enough not to know about the culture of the country. It's not good enough just to be one step ahead of the children. I'm sorry, but it's not. I have a real concern about that, because that will impact obviously on the experience that they have and then the kind of future that they're able to kind of enter into secondary education, because it impacts in secondary as well. I think the models that are being flagged up just now, some are very, very interesting, but I think we have to look long term. And I think people need to kind of shy away from looking at a kind of sticking plaster over it. I think they really have to look long term. If Scottish Government are going to put their money where their mouth is, which they've done for this session and they've also said for the next two, then people really need to look at a long term plan, because it will not be delivered unless they do.
Okay. So, I think we probably need to call it a day on that one, in our new disciplined edition. See?
So, es un problema grande para la gente del colegios, ¿no?
Sí, va a ser un problema enormemente, y tenemos que hacer un montón de cosas, tenemos que pensar, tenemos que trabajar juntos y eso, pero que hablas bien el español, ¿no?
Bante,
sí. Yeah, it's probably a bite off more than you can chew, Jave. Good man.
Yeah, I'm at my desk. Look, I've just Googled that last phrase. That's all I've got.
Oh, en serio?
It was good. Yeah, you had chops there. There's no doubt about it. Anyway, Gillian, obviously it'd be great if you come and join us again. Sorry, Jay. It'd be good if you come and join us again whenever you like. You've been a great guest, great fun. Where can people find out more about what you're doing and more about your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. That sounds smashing fun. Let's do that again. And I promise I won't mention about battering anybody.
Sure. No, but I was just asking, where can people find out more about what you're doing?
I shall send my details to you and you can pass them on.
Okay, that's great. And on Twitter, of course, you're on Twitter as well.
Yes, I'm on Twitter as Senora CT, I am, indeed.
Excellent, okay. And Jay, listeners who haven't heard you for a wee while will be dying to catch up. Twitter for you, or is there anything else?
Twitter for me, at Learning Jay. I have a blog now. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put a post to my blog up on Twitter as well.
Fantastic, I was unaware of that. You should have sent me a link. See, I'm all hot and huffy now. So, Gillian on Twitter, Jay on Twitter, and you've got a new blog as well, Jay, which you're going to give us a link to, which is great. Just to flag up, we've got a couple of really interesting guests coming up in the near future. I know we've got another episode next week. I can't recall who it is, but we'll get that on the blog page. But we do have Vivian Brown, who is very authoritative in in careers. That's you, that's right, yeah. In careers education, and she's going to be first guest in January. We've then got Professor John Macbeth returning after a long absence to talk about his new book. And in fact, he's going to do selected readings from his new book, which is something of a retrospective and largely autobiographical, as well as reflections on the education systems, both local and national, and how we're learning. And would you believe we then shortly after have the Cabinet Secretary guesting?
So,
oh, is this the lady who works for the company that makes shelving units?
Well, actually, I better check the email again just to make sure I haven't misunderstood. Maybe it is that one. But we were rather hoping it might be Mike Russell to talk about some futures thinking in education and more of a personal thing for him, just to help out the podcast. All that remains for me to say is it's been a really great podcast. Thanks, Gillian, for guesting. It's been fantastic. Good to see you again, Jay. And till next week, everyone, thanks and good night.
Good night.